Terror in New Jersey. Three women whose lives are permanently intertwined by the horrific actions of one man. But are there more of his victims in the Garden State? Episode 59 of Crime Over Wine starts right now. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Crime Over Wine, the only podcast with head-scratching true crime stories that are just better over a bottle of wine. I'm your host, Liam Collins, and y'all, my guest co-host is one of my new favorite human beings on Earth, and I know you all are going to love her just as much as I do. My guest co-host this week is the host of Heather's Most Precious, a podcast about what we all find most precious. My guest co-host this week is Heather Hendrickson. Hello, Heather. How are you doing? My friend.
Hey, Liam. I am doing so well. I am so excited to be on this episode with you.
Yes, me too. So listen, Heather and I really didn't meet all that long ago, like maybe a couple months ago. We're already fast friends. We're kindred spirits for sure. But I was on her her podcast a couple weeks ago. Again, Heather's Most Precious. We had a great chat. Yes. So go check that out if you haven't already. But I need to know, Heather, about your podcast, where this idea kind of came from, because I know you have a terrific outlook on life, but I need to know kind of how this kind of fits into that a little bit more.
Absolutely. So I am a naturally positive and grateful person. I think that the idea for this came long before I was actually willing to do it, but then over time realized that it's okay that some podcasts like yours fit into a specific box. You are specifically Crime Over Wine, right? Mm-hmm. These stories, head scratching stories. And I wanted to be able to talk about whatever came to mind, whether it was business related, whether it was relationships, whether it was, fun stories, just to bring joy to people, be a little bright spot in their day. So the idea for Heather's Most Precious came about, and it has been such an unbelievable experience getting to talk with people, not only about what they have been and currently are doing and what they anticipate doing in the future, are sharing stories of resilience and finding themselves in the midst of this life, but also being able to hear what they find most precious. In other words, what do they hold most dear? And I used to think that it would be the typical, right? You know, family, boyfriend, girlfriend, all of this stuff.
Right.
And yet I am so surprised every week that when I ask that question, it's something just beautiful and new, and it's not overdone or this repetitive in any way. So it's been so much fun.
Yeah. And you're so good at it too. Your personality is just like perfect for what you're doing. I love you so much. I hold you most precious.
Thank you. I love you right back.
And you know, it's, it's funny because when you think about like something like that's like most precious to you, like there's so many, you can take that so many different ways. Like you said, like a lot of people say, probably think to say like their friends or family, I said my dogs, but like there's so many different ways you can kind of take that question, and whether it's that 2 minute walk that you take every morning, that's maybe the most precious thing that you have going on, because that is just the way to get your day started, and it sets up the building blocks for everything else. That was just the first thing that popped into my mind. But it's so interesting to because what you're doing, you it's so many different people, so many different perspectives, so many different walks of life, and they all get to talk to you, and what a blessing that is. So
they are so lucky.
Correct. Well, let's toast our new friendship over a glass of wine here, Heather. Let's do it.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about what we're drinking this week. We are drinking Linen Sauvignon Blanc. It's crisp, delicious, and the perfect wine to pair with any day that ends in Y, my kind of wine. It has crisp citrus, candied pear, and green apple aromatics, and is balanced with flavors of pear, grapefruit, Granny Smith apples, with a wisp of peach on the finish. And so, Heather, last time when I was on the podcast, I surprised you with a little bottle of wine, which I don't really know how much of a surprise that was, because like it's me. But I am. But we did a red on your when I came on your podcast. Now we're drinking a white. Which do you typically? Are you a red girl, white girl, pink girl, bubbly girl?
White. Bubbly, if I could choose, but white all the way.
Love that. Do you have like a specific type of, a specific type of white that you typically go for?
No, I don't like super dry wines. Y'all hear the super southern accent right here on my eyes. but no, I'm not going to turn down a good glass of wine.
I love that about you. Well, cheers to you, Heather. Thank you so much for coming on this week. So great to see you.
That is really good.
That is really good. I was not what I was expecting at all either. This is fascinating.
Almost florally.
It is a little florally, and it has like a interesting, I'm reading what's in here and trying to pick this much out, and I can't really
get what
flavor I'm getting on the back end. There's like honeysuckle, no, like Granny Smith apples. Yeah. Is that what we're getting?
Maybe. It's delicious.
I think that's, you know what I mean? It's like a little bit like the back of the mouth. There's like a little kick to it, and I can't really, and it's fruity for sure. I just can't figure out which of these 17 fruits that they just named is what I'm tasting here. Maybe, it says a wisp of peach on the finish. Let me see if that's peach.
It could be. Almost like the white peach.
Oh, that's definitely a white peach for sure. Yes, for sure, 100%. But no, it's like a fruit salad of all different types of stuff. And it's an experience all the way from the front of the mouth to the back of the mouth. There is a lot of things going on in this. And I think it's going to be interesting because usually after it breathes for a while, you get it, kind of a lot of those flavors kind of blend together and you get a nice little mixture of stuff. Right now, it's very distinct flavors. Just opening it up that I opened up 2 minutes ago. You're getting a lot of different distinct flavors here. And so I'm really curious to know what it's going to taste like once it kind of breathes out for a second.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, Heather, I have probably one of the most terrifying cases that I've ever heard of. Honestly, I'm not going to lie. We're about to go on like a ride. And so I hope that you're kind of buckled in. I hope you have something to grab onto. Hope you have a nice full bottle of wine for you, because we have a lot to discuss here, Heather. And it's quite a case. It's dense. So I hope you're ready for it. I hope you came ready for what we're about to talk about.
Absolutely. I'm bracing myself.
All right. Well, Heather, this week I want to tell you the story of three women whose lives were completely separate from one another, but whose stories have been forever entangled with each other. Now, this week, Heather, I want to tell you the stories of Robin West, Sarah Butler, and Joanne Brown, the victims of the New Jersey serial killer. Like a lot of women her age, 19-year-old Robin West was just trying to figure things out. In the summer of 2016, she posted her entire life on social media. Her friends recall being able to figure out how things were going based on the color of her hair and the selfies that she posted. Big, bright colors matched with a brighter smile meant things were going pretty well, but darker colors like black or brown meant things were just not. Despite some issues growing up, Robin remained headstrong and kind. She was living in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and still remained in pretty close contact with her closest family members, even though a lot of them had kind of went their separate ways. But Robin had still fell on hard times and was trying to figure out how she fit into this big, crazy world. So she turned to sex work and dancing at a club in West Philadelphia while she figured that much out. And she actually really liked what she was doing, despite knowing, at least in the back of her head, that she could be so much more than that. And while she was participating in this lifestyle, she was really safe about it. She practiced the industry's version of the buddy system. She was always with a friend and ensured that someone always knew where she was going and who she was going there with. On August 31st, 2016, Robin West was just days away from turning 20 years old, and she was looking forward to that major milestone birthday. That night, she was working. Robin and a friend decided to head out to Newark to try to get a client, and not long after they hit the streets of Newark, a man in a car drove up to the two women and made his intentions clear. Robin's friend asked who he wanted, and he pointed right at Robin. Robin climbed into the car and drove off. Her friend wrote down the license plate as a standard operating procedure for them, completely unaware that that would be the last time she would see her friend Robin alive.
Oh my goodness. How terrifying. So it seems like Robin's friend anticipated, right? She could sense that something wasn't right here, but yet still sent her friend in the car.
Yeah, so actually, not really, actually, Heather. So if you, from what I understand about her, about Robin and her friend's relationship, this was like what they did, right? Like when one of them went off with a guy, the other one would take down as much as they could about that guy. So that way, God forbid anything happened, then they would have as much information
as possible.
Just to
be proactive in case.
Yeah, well, and if you think about it, right? Like a lot of those, you know, a lot of the people that we're talking about, you know, or put themselves, or not a lot of them, all of them put themselves into precarious situations every day, right? Every time they go to work, for lack of better words, right? And so I think that it's in the back of, and a lot of these people, right? Because a lot of, you know, the presumptions about sex workers and these folks are that they're, you know, promiscuous, that they're, you know, they live on the edge and all this stuff. But frankly, from just speaking specifically off the cases that I've covered about sex workers and people in that industry, you know, they're some of the most like precautious people that I've ever heard of, in terms of like, you know, like they're very aware that they're in dangerous situations on the regular, and so they do the things to you know, protect themselves, to do you know, as much as you can to protect yourself, right?
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. I am so glad that she did have a friend though that was willing to look out for her.
Right
We all need those people.
Yeah, and you know, I always say too, you know, we talk about this in different contexts on this podcast, but like having someone who's there to watch your back at any time, right, is so important. Like having somebody whose only mission in whatever y'all are doing is to make sure that you get home safely, and we're gonna do whatever it takes to make that happen, whether it's, you know, going out to a friend or with a friend, you know, at a bar that night, or a club, or whatever, or whether it's, you know, engaging in a lifestyle that's, you know, inherently dangerous. You know, it's always good to have somebody there who's gonna write down the license plate when you can't do it yourself, right?
Absolutely. So I have to know, what happened to Robin?
Well, just a few hours after Robin had climbed into the car, Heather, a call came in from Orange, New Jersey. A neighbor had called in for help because a house on the street was on fire, engulfed in flames. Firefighters showed up and immediately started knocking it down, and just a few hours later, they succeeded. Once investigators arrive to check out the scene of the home, they are immediately suspicious because neighbors by this point had told them that the home where they had just spent hours knocking down flames was believed to be abandoned. So they searched throughout the house cautiously. They searched through the first floor, clear it, nothing odd really, but then they get to the second floor. And as they look through the charred remains of the home, they see what they know to be a body lying there in the middle of the floor, clearly deceased.
How terrifying. I can't even imagine being one of the neighbors that saw this, right? When they're not expecting anybody to be there. And then as the first responders are in there, now we see that there is a victim.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, and like, you know, firefighters, investigators, you know, are in, you know, see these kinds of things all the time, right? Where it's like, and I can only imagine what was going through their minds at first when they see, like, you know, someone who had, you know, passed away in this home, in this abandoned home, you know, probably a homeless person, you know, whoever it may be. I can promise you, though, whatever they were imagining was happening here, it was not what was actually happening. So I can promise you the presumptions did not match the reality of the situation at all.
Well, Liam, I know what assuming typically means, but I am assuming that this is Robin, right?
Yeah. Well, in this situation, Heather, you would be correct, but it's not actually immediately clear. Her body is badly damaged. Okay. And by the point they had found this body, Robin's family and friends had only just started getting just a little bit suspicious that she hadn't returned when they had expected her to. And they wouldn't report her missing until later that day. But 2 weeks later, investigators were able to determine using dental records that the remains did indeed belong to Robin West.
Oh my goodness. Could they tell how she died?
Well, not specifically, Heather. Based on what I can tell, it seemed as though investigators had been suspicious of the circumstances of her death and could tell that her cause of death wasn't exclusively related to the fire. But that's pretty much all I can kind of tell from the situation here. But for weeks, Robin's family just stood confused about what happened to Robin. They had heard rumors that she may have been engaging in risky behavior, engaging in sex work, but most of them, frankly, frankly, didn't really believe it for themselves. So how could their incredible Robin find herself in a situation that could have led her life to end in a suspicious house fire at an abandoned home? And once the immediate grieving period and time of disbelief had passed and the reality had started to set in, Robin's family and friends remained determined to find the person responsible, if there was a person who was actually indeed responsible. And then just a few weeks later, the tri-state area was shook again by the news that even more women were going missing from in and around Essex County. Crime Over Wine is sponsored by BetterHelp. As someone who's used therapy for years, I know that finding a therapist can sometimes be a stress on its own, juggling your full-time job, your family, your friends, your podcast, and trying to find the right therapist on top of that can almost feel impossible. That's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp matches you with a therapist that works for you on your terms. It's online, it's remote, and by filling out a few questions, BetterHelp can match you to one of 33,000 licensed professional therapists in as little as a few days. And because finding a new therapist is a lot like finding a new bottle of wine, if you don't jive with your therapist, you can easily switch to a new one at no additional cost. You can get 10% off your first month of BetterHelp by going to BetterHelp.com/crimeoverwine. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/crimeoverwine for 10% off your first month. Join over 4 million people who decided to get help and get happy with BetterHelp. Twenty-year-old Sarah Butler grew up a dancer. She discovered her love for dance at just 5 years old and never looked back. In 2016, she was a freshman at New Jersey City University in Jersey City, where she was studying media arts, but she grew up and lived in Philadelphia, and on November 22nd, 2016, her mother made the drive up to Jersey City to pick Sarah up for Thanksgiving break. As soon as she got back, just about, Sarah asked her mom to borrow her van so she could go see some friends, and her mother agreed. Sarah said she would be home by 8 that night, but when that time came and went without Sarah, her mother calls her. The call went to voicemail, and immediately the instinct hit and the panic set in. Something was wrong. And so Sarah's mother called her friends to ask if Sarah was around, and they all said no, they had not seen her. The next day, when Sarah still wasn't around, her mom calls the local hospital to see if she had been in some bad accident or something, but nothing. So her next call was to the Montclair Police Department, and she decides after that conversation to report her daughter missing.
All right, as a mother myself, I can only imagine how terrified her mother was, knowing that something wasn't right, that this was not her normal behavior, and then taking it a step further to call her friend, you know, her daughter's friends. And then, oh my goodness, could you imagine just that panic that begins trying to find your daughter, sensing that something is not right?
Yeah. Man. Well, and that, and you know, we talk about this so many times on this podcast again, but like the instinct of a mom, am I right? Like, you know, knowing right away that there was just something wrong here, and she can't really, like, you know, put her finger on it, but she knows that this would not have happened unless something was seriously wrong with Sarah, and like, you know, going for it, like, you know, and again, this was, you know, this was 12 hours, maybe a little bit more later, after Sarah was supposed to be home, and she's now calling everybody, including the police and the hospital and all the people who may have her daughter.
Oh my goodness, I feel, oh, my heart goes out.
Well, 2 days later, the fear took over even more, Heather, when the van that Sarah had borrowed was found abandoned in Orange, New Jersey. And that's when Sarah's friends and family knew that something was legitimately wrong. Sarah's sister returned home from searching that van that day and immediately logged onto Sarah's computer. She flipped open the laptop, typed in the password to all of her accounts, which Sarah had trusted her with long ago. And that's when she finds something truly disturbing, Heather. It was a series of messages between Sarah and an account named Little Yacht Rock on a website called Tagged, a social media website primarily used to arrange sexual encounters in exchange for money.
Wait, So was Sarah a sex worker as well?
Well, no, actually, Heather, but I guess Sarah was just using this website to, like, meet new people, I guess. In fact, among the messages Sarah's sister was looking at were messages where Little Yacht Rock offered $500 to Sarah for sex, and Sarah initially accepted it, but then actually decided to back down. She got a little bit too nervous, but just a few days later, on November 22nd, 2016, Sarah reached back out to Little Yacht Rock to apologize for backing out on him, saying that she had just gotten a little bit nervous about the whole thing. But that night, Sarah said that she had reconsidered and agreed to meet up with him, but first, probably a bit tongue-in-cheek, but, like, just absolutely chilling in hindsight, Sarah asked him, quote, "You're not a serial killer, right?"
Oh my goodness. So do you think that she sensed something, or do you think it's like most people back in the day when we used to talk a lot more on social media and things, and there were meeting ups? I think of, like, back to the MySpace days when it was so new and unknown, right? Tells you how old I am. But that was kind of the running joke was like, oh, I hope this person's a good person. I hope that they are who they say they are and I'm not being catfished. Yeah. Do you think it was just that premonition, or do you think she was truly scared?
I think it was probably a little combination of both, Heather. I think that it was probably a little bit of, like, you're giving me kind of weird vibes. And he even said in some of these messages that he was like, yeah, like, I'm a really good guy once you get to know me, or something like that, which, like, obviously you're not going to say, you know, that right off the bat that you're not a good dude, you know, or that you're not going to like me after you get to know me. So just kind of weird thing to say, but whatever. But again, kind of what you were saying, right? It's probably a little bit of, she probably sensed something off in him, because, like, everyone has, like, you know, instinct of, like, normal, what normal interactions are like, and what interactions with people who aren't normal are like. And so I think there was a little bit of that, but I also think there's, like, a good chance that it was just one of those, like, you know, maybe she was a little bit nervous just because she's never done something like this before, and so she was like, oh, you're not a serial, like, it was like, haha, like, supposed to be a joke. But again, not really funny in hindsight, again, and we're gonna talk a lot about why this is kind of a creepy message in hindsight.
Well, I'm so glad that we have this linen bottle of wine for this.
Correct. We're going to listen, Heather, you're going to need every single drop. Okay. We're just scratching the surface here. But, you know, Sarah's sister and her friends were just absolutely purely outraged and were determined to find out who Little Yacht Rock was, because they were convinced that he was probably the last person to see Sarah before she disappeared. So convinced this user had something to do with whatever happened to Sarah, they actually end up deciding to make a fake profile using a fake name and somebody else's pictures to smoke him out. They made the profile, found Little Yacht Rock on Tagged, and messaged him. It wasn't long after that when he offered the fake profile money in exchange for sex. And the girls agreed and arranged a meeting at a Panera Bread store. Only, they had, of course, no intentions of actually showing up. Instead, they called police and told them what they had set up with Little Yacht Rock. Police showed up to the Panera Bread store, and there he was. There was Little Yacht Rock in a flesh. They approached him and told him why they were there and who they were, and he told police that his real name was Khalil Wheeler Weaver, and he cooperated with the questions police were asking him. He didn't deny meeting up with Sarah, but he did tell them that he dropped her off afterwards and was willing to do whatever he could to help them find her.
Which I don't believe at all. I don't know him, but I also don't believe him in this situation. But how brave of her friends to do that.
Right.
Knowing that this could be a lead. And of course, they're trying to find their friend, figure out what happened. But there are a lot of people that would not take that step. They wouldn't want to put themselves in danger. So first of all, brave. Second, how smart to go ahead and bring the police in to help. I couldn't imagine at their age that I would have been smart enough to create my own sting, right? That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, and it reminds me, too, of the Emma Walker case. We covered that back on episode 20, where, like, the friends went even further than that, Heather. It was a case up in Knoxville.
Right.
Yeah. And so they, like, actually, like, got into the car with Riley and were, like, you know, getting, like, helping him, quote unquote, dispose of evidence. And all of a sudden, like, the blue lights, you know, flashed. And so, and, like, they were wearing mics or, wires and all. It was crazy. And so like props to, you know, some good friends out here who like, you know, recognize when things aren't right. But also, you know, props to Sarah a little bit here. And, you know, and I'm guilty of this myself, personally. But like people who you should always have somebody who can get into your phone. You should always have someone who can get into your, you know, Facebook page, into your social media websites, into your computer, whatever it is. Because, you know, these days there is evidence of your every single move, yes, you know, in on all these devices. And so they are such critical pieces of evidence, in hindsight, right? Because it would have been so easy, because I'm assuming that Sarah probably didn't really tell anybody that she was on this website. And so it would have been so easy to just like keep those passwords to herself. And she didn't. She had the foresight to be like, well, you know, and maybe it was just because, you know, hey, here's my password kind of thing. Maybe there wasn't much thought in there. But I like to think that she gave her sister the password because she knew that, you know, that it might come in handy one day.
And that is super eye-opening too, because so often someone might have the password to your phone, but so often you're told to keep passwords private and keep it secretive. And right, there's right, all of this talk about that. And so you should have at least one person that you do trust that would be able to, God forbid something happen, be able to take a look and to take care of you. So in this way, so that is, right, that's huge.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, police, unfortunately, though, had no evidence to take Khalil into custody at that moment, or evidence, frankly, that a crime had even been committed by this point. But they did have probable cause to get a search warrant based on those messages. And so police tracked Khalil's movements around the time that Sarah had went missing using his phone records. And when they get that data back on December 1st, they retrace his steps. Those steps take them to an abandoned home in Orange, where Khalil had told Sarah to meet him that night. Then that path takes police to Eagle Rock Reservation, a mountain park in West Orange, New Jersey. They take the path all the way up to the top of the reservation, look around, and that is where they find Sarah Butler's lifeless body under leaves and debris, and with a piece of clothing tied around her neck and her face wrapped in tape.
Oh my goodness. How devastating. And at this point, that I know we just talked about, they basically let him walk. They did what they could, but they didn't have the evidence. At this point, please tell me that was enough for them to arrest Khalil.
Yeah, well, not quite yet, Heather. His cell phone did put him there, but that isn't necessarily enough evidence to prove that he did, in fact, kill her. But while they're waiting to gather even more evidence, police get another call on December 5th. It's from a pair of contractors who had found another woman's lifeless body, Heather. And when police find out where they were being dispatched to, their hearts stop. It's the same address to the same home where Khalil had asked Sarah to meet him just 2 weeks prior. Get ready for that big test with Study.com. Study.com offers learning materials and test prep, even LSAT study prep guides for all of my legal nerds listening. Unfortunately, there aren't any wine study guides, and believe me, I did check. Listeners can get 30% off their first 3 months of any subscription level using the promo code CRIMEOVERWINE. Again, that's promo code CRIMEOVERWINE, no spaces, for 30% off your first 3 months at Study.com. Learn faster, stay motivated, study smarter with our sponsor, Study.com. All right, Heather, this is real intense, dense case here, but the wine is pretty light. Am I right about that?
Yes. So right. So right. This reminds me of like a girl's brunch.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right? True. I do feel like, right? I'm having brunch with the girls. That's so true.
Yes. Yeah, something fun, something celebratory, something very light, not too heavy. So, yeah, brunch. A like a Linner, maybe, I don't know, but just something, maybe even, you've gotten together to celebrate, I don't know, birth of a baby or someone's getting married or something like this. This would be a terrific addition.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, it's funny because we were talking at the beginning of the podcast about how like a lot of these flavors were very, very distinct that we were talking about and how they tend to mix in together. I'm getting like they've definitely softened and all that stuff, but I'm still getting that very potent, you know, distinct flavor in the back of the mouth. I think what we talked about that was the
Like peach? A white peach or something.
I can't even. Yeah. Yeah, white peach. Yeah, yeah. And so I'm still very much still getting that though.
I would agree. It does to me still have this, it almost like a honeysuckle. I know that ingredient's not in there. They should just put it on the label. But it is a little bit sweet. It's not overbearing, but it's enough that it just it makes it really refreshing.
Yeah, it is really refreshing, and it's not too sweet. It's definitely a lighter in color kind of white here that we're talking about.
Yes,
and it's not too sweet. But it's really not too dry either for a Sauvignon Blanc. And you're I know, and you're my you know anti dry girly, and so I'm wondering if it's too dry for you.
It is not at all. It has definitely expanded my palate. So there we are.
Well, there you go. Well, mission accomplished on Crime Over Wine. That's all I'm here for. Love that.
Yes.
Well, Heather, not to change the topic into a much darker, you know, situation than the wine that we're talking about here. But when we just left off, we were about to talk about a third woman. And so you want to hear what happens there?
I do and I don't. We have to finish the story, but I'm absolutely terrified because I just have this feeling that Khalil is involved in all of it. Because wasn't the first girl, that was also an orange, New Jersey as well, right?
Yes, that is correct. Yeah, right. And again, two, you know, same area and two women who were, you know, engaging in, you know, like Sarah wasn't a sex worker, but still, kind of you know, talking behavior. About potentially, risky behavior, kind of, you know, potentially sex for money, you know, kind of thing. Like, and she turned it down, to be clear. But like, point being is that's kind of all in the same vein.
Of course.
So, yeah. You want to get back in there?
I'm nervous I do. We have to get going. Yes.
Yeah, let's do it. Well, the woman that we're talking about here, Heather, her name was Joanne Brown. She was in the second floor of the abandoned home, and on December 5th, the home's owner had called for contractors to go to the house to give an estimate to fix the house up. Joanne, similarly to Sarah, had been strangled to death using a piece of clothing, which was still wrapped around her neck, with a piece of tape that, you know, was still wrapped around her face, just like the way that Sarah was found.
Holy mess. It just keeps happening. Oh my goodness. It's too much. Yeah. So what actually happened to Joanne?
Well, Joanne was also known to have participated in sex work to get along, Heather. She also worked as a dancer at a local club, but she was so much more than that. She loved fashion and loved to style hair, specifically her own. But growing up wasn't easy for Joanne. She had grown up in a troubled home and had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. But by the time she was 32, she was well acquainted with the lifestyle she was living, and she was totally good with it. Like most women who participate in sex work, like we were talking about, she knew she was living a dangerous lifestyle, and just like Robin, always made sure someone knew where she was and who she was with. On October 22nd, 2016, she was out eating with friends when a man approached them and offered them money in exchange for sex. Joanne agreed and gave her friend her cell phone, saying that she would call the phone to tell her where she was going to be and where they could find her. When in the car with the man, she asked to borrow the man's phone, and he agreed. She called her friend, told her the address where she was going to be, and hung up. That address was the same one where Joanne was found dead inside of just 6 weeks later. The same home where Sarah would meet up with Khalil Wheeler Weaver before being killed herself.
Oh my goodness. I feel like that's all I keep saying because this is so unimaginable. Right.
Well, and let's talk about this too, because I have to. So Joanne went missing on October 22nd, 2016. Sarah went missing on November 22nd, 2016, and then Joanne was found on December 5th. And so, point being is like Sarah went right to that. Like Khalil asked Sarah to come right to that house where Joanne was already dead on the second floor, and then Sarah went to this, like, you know, this, like, park, this mountain park.
Right.
And so that just gives me the chills, right, of just, like, you were, like, feet away from this other woman. It makes me sick.
And you had no idea. Had no idea.
Right. How could you? How could you have? Right. And it also makes me think about a lot, and we have talked about this too again before, but like how, like, this, these are things for the most part that, like, most people, you know, Sarah's aide specifically would do, right? Like, they would go hang out with guys, make decisions that maybe weren't always the best. But like today that happens all the time, where it's just we live online and you meet people online. Like, I think about all the people like who I know through a screen, mm-hmm. just because, like, through podcasting and that kind of thing. And it's like, and it like, obviously, like it's a little different because I'm not, like, you know, doing what Sarah was doing. And not to say that it's, like, better or worse, but point being is that, like that's just the type of world that we live in. And it's just, mm-hmm. it's just kind of unfortunate, I suppose, unfortunate, terrible, sad, tragic that, like, it was just the wrong person, right? And again, we're like, you know, allegedly the wrong person. We're going to talk about that a little bit later on, but still.
Yeah, and I mean, as you said, we have normalized this. This is how people are meeting. This is how, especially after the pandemic, when that's all you had, mm-hmm. we're being able to see each other and find that community, right. which looked different because now it's online. And then I even know people who have met on dating sites that did the face-to-face and did the texting and talking, and they're married. And so you're right. Yeah. There's just so few people that have encounters like this, which are obviously devastating and life-ending. Right. Oh my goodness. That is absolutely, absolutely devastating. So tell me, we've got now her body. We've talked about this. What happens next?
Well, police were able to use more of Khalil's phone records to prove that he was indeed at the house that day, tying him as the man who picked Joanne up on October 22nd. So on December 6, 2016, you're going to be happy to hear this, Heather, police arrested Khalil and charged him with the murder and sexual assault of both Sarah Butler and Joanne Brown.
It's about time, and I'm sorry to celebrate when we're talking about something that is so tragic and so big, but I am so glad that they are finally able, right, to go after him. That is the one thing about the justice system that makes me crazy, when everything looks like it's pointing. And of course, we were not there at the time. Right. So this is me, right, us looking at it well past, but how hard that is when everything looks like it's lining up, and yet they are still, their hands are tied.
Right, right. Yeah, and to be fair, like, again, we talked about this so many times, but, like, you need, like, the case, right? To, like, be like, yes, this is the foolproof thing. We're confident this is our dude. Like, there's no doubt in our minds. And so, like, props to them, I guess, there. But also, like, thinking about, to me, the, like, because so Joanne was, so going, rewinding a little bit here, Sarah was found on December 1st. Joanne was found on December 5th. And then that's when they were able to piece all this stuff together and get enough evidence to prove that to arrest Khalil on December 6th. So point being is that, like, imagine, and like both in both of those situations, like, were Sarah, not maybe not so much, but certainly Joanne was a situation where, like, let's say that this homeowner didn't call the contractor to go to that house that day. You know what I mean? And so Joanne could have just been sitting there for weeks, months. And so God knows if they would have had enough to arrest Khalil. And so point being is who knows if he could have gone out and done this again, if we didn't get, if Joanne didn't just happen to be found on December 5th.
Exactly. So we've got this, and in the grand scheme of things, it seems like they did act pretty quickly and were able to put this together. And you're right, there are so often that they know if they act prematurely, it could ruin the entire case. And then they would allow this person to walk, or they would allow something, right? So you know that all of this is done in a certain order. But is this truly going to stick? And my other question is, did they find other victims of Khalil?
Well, hold that thought, Heather. Both of those thoughts, because we are definitely going to talk about both of those things for sure. Unfortunately, you're not going to like the answer to one of those questions. I'll just put it that way. And you can decide which one you're not going to like the answer to when we come back later. But So hold those thoughts for sure. But Khalil ended up pleading not guilty and was held on a $1 million bond. His defense attorney said in court that there was no evidence that directly tied Khalil to the crimes, but didn't deny being with either of the victims before they disappeared, interestingly enough. He said that in both of those cases, he dropped them both off safely after being with them and claimed that he was being framed. And by March of 2017, prosecutors had laid out their case against Khalil to a grand jury, which indicted him on several charges related to Sarah Butler and Joanne Brown's murders, as well as the murder of Robin West. By this point, investigators had been able to tie him using his phone records to the home where Robin's charred body was found the night that she had died. Khalil denied all of this, but again, said that he was indeed with Robin that day, but he dropped her off safely at the abandoned home that was later engulfed in flames, but that was it.
But do we actually believe him? No.
No. To be clear, no, not at all. Because again, if that happens once, like, that's suspicious to me. That happens three times where your cell phone puts you with a victim of a murder who, and all three of those victims died in, like, really weirdly, you know, similar ways.
Right.
Yeah, no. And, like, it's just weird to me because, like, people will come up with all sorts of excuses about, like, oh, I wasn't really with them. Like, no, you can't prove that, blah, blah, blah. He's, like, straight up saying, yeah, I was with them, but, like, I didn't kill them. I was with them the night that they died, but I didn't kill them.
And I dropped him off safely at an abandoned home. Like, that's not
the
safe.
The home. That's not safe. The exact same. Right. Well, yeah, true. But, like, the exact same home where she was found 12 hours later.
Right. Yeah, that's wild. And you're right. All of their murders were very similar. And there's a pattern. It's obviously a pattern.
Right.
Three times. Golly. And yeah, you have to tell me where does the story lead us next?
Oh, down a rabbit hole of all different things, Heather. We are not anywhere close to being finished with this thing. Do you have the rest of your bottle handy?
I do. About to pour another glass.
Good. Excellent. You're going to need it because that wasn't all, Heather. Because along with those indictments for charges on murder, sexual assault, arson, and others, Khalil was also being charged with attempted murder. Because by this point, word had gotten around about the monster Khalil Wheeler Weaver was accused of being in New Jersey. And so police got wind of information tying him to a fourth woman. Only this woman survived.
It's Michelle Herron, the co-host of Crime Over Wine Weekly, a brand new show keeping you up to date on the latest in the true crime world. We know how much you rely on Crime Over Wine on Wednesdays to learn about a new case, but on Crime Over Wine Weekly, you'll hear our takes on the cases making the headlines. Join us every Sunday for a new episode of your new crime and wine obsession.
Now, I do have to warn you all that we are about to get into a lot of details that involve graphic descriptions of sexual assault. So if you are sensitive to that, skip ahead a few minutes. And I will also say that if you or anyone you know is a victim of sexual assault and you need help, call the National Sexual Assault Hotline at 1-800-656-4673. We are also going to put that number on our website and in our show notes, too. Okay, let's get back to the case, Heather. The woman we're talking about, her name is Tiffany Taylor. She was 34 years old in 2016, and on November 15th, she was several months pregnant. As she later testified in Khalil's murder trial, Tiffany said that she agreed to meet up with a man in exchange for sex. He picked Tiffany up at a motel in Elizabeth, New Jersey, where a different guy had been paying for her to stay. When he picked her up, the man was wearing a ski mask covering half of his face, gloves, and he was wearing a hat with a hood over it. Now, it was November in New Jersey, and it was pretty cold out, so Tiffany, for whatever reason, didn't really think much of all of this. They drove around for a bit trying to find a motel they could stay in and have sex, but they weren't able to get a motel room because neither of them had any IDs. Tiffany was just about to give up for the night and asked the man to drive her back to her original hotel room when suddenly he hit her over the head. When she regained consciousness, the man was raping her in the back of his car. Her hands were cuffed behind her back, and her mouth was covered in duct tape, and he was strangling her. She had lost consciousness several times during this whole attack, but between the tears she was crying and the blood coming from her mouth from biting down on her tongue, the duct tape covering her mouth had loosened, and she cried out she was pregnant. And the man replies, saying, "He knows." And it was at that point when the man took his mask off, and she was shocked to see the man that she knew to be Khalil Wheeler Weaver.
I can't even. How devastating to know you're pregnant and to be experiencing this, and then to know the assailant.
Mm-hmm.
How did she know Khalil?
Well, yeah, Heather, it's kind of complicated, but as, you know, Tiffany would later testify, Tiffany had actually met with Khalil before. Khalil had been messaging her a lot to pay her for sex, but she had refused over and over and over again because Khalil had actually been having sex with her friend. But one night, she gave in. She agreed to meet up with him and have sex with him for $200, but when she got into his room and he gave her the money, she said that she had forgotten the condoms that she brought in her car and went to get them, but never came back. And so during this attack, months later, Khalil asked if he looked familiar and said that she had cheated him.
What? How on earth did she get away from him, especially during that attack?
Yeah, well, after the attack, Heather, Tiffany asked Khalil to take her back to her motel room so that she could get her cell phone, and he agreed. When they arrived at the motel, Khalil followed her to the room, but once again, she outsmarted him. She slammed the door in his face and deadbolted it, and she said that she stood out there slamming on it and screaming at her for minutes, but eventually he left. Tiffany immediately called police, who showed up a while later to take a report from Tiffany with one handcuff still dangling from her wrist. But it was clear to her that they were only interested in her lifestyle as a prostitute and that they were not about to take her attack very seriously. So they left, and Tiffany took herself to the hospital the next day, and that was the end of it.
So this is horrendous. The attack itself, she's pregnant. I can't even imagine how terrified she is for her baby during this. And then you think, knocking in and out, was she thinking like, oh my gosh, this is a nightmare? And then to the adrenaline that would come from getting away.
Yeah.
Thankfully, she called the police. Yeah. But then the police not to believe her.
Yeah. Different level of frustrating, right? And like, we've seen this so many times. And like, again, this is why sex workers get attacked this way and never say a word about it, right? Like, or like have all these horrible bad things happen to them and never say a word about it because they're afraid that they might get arrested themselves. And this is exactly the reason why that happens, because they've been there before, right? Where they have this horrendous, horrendous attack happen to them, and their immediate instinct is, okay, well, let me call police. And they just don't do anything about it. Like, what? I mean, she knows who he is.
And not even to look into it.
Right. And like, there's this kind of odd thing right to here also, which is interesting to me anyways. But so they were able to, and this is way more in the weeds than I intended to get into, but it's based on a true story, I suppose. And so Tiffany testified later in the trial that that she texted Khalil after he left and told him to come back, actually, because he had her keys, because he had a car that belonged to her or that she was using or whatever, and he went off with it, that he still had the keys that she had. And so she texted him and said, come back and bring my keys. And not expecting him to do it, and he did. He came back and, like, dropped the keys off at the door. And then based on the cell phone records that they had, they were able to figure out that while police were at the motel asking Tiffany questions about this, Khalil was, like, in the woods next to the motel watching this whole thing happen.
What?
And so point being, and was there for, like, 10 minutes after they left as well. And so point being is that, like, after this whole thing happens, like, you don't search the property to, like, which, like, right, I don't know what the layout of this motel is, but, like, point being is that, like, you, like, this happens and you don't believe it that much that you like, it's just not,
you don't even look around,
you don't even look in, and like, maybe it was like a separate, like, far enough away in the woods, like, I don't really know much about that much, but like, point being is that, like, he was right there while you were right there.
And you know what's so sad about that is they didn't do their due diligence.
Mm-hmm.
at all. That's so discouraging. That's so discouraging.
Yeah. Well, and again, like, I just can't, I just have to, unfortunately, believe that, like, if Tiffany was a white woman who wasn't a sex worker and this had happened to her, what would have happened, right? Like, again, just because you're a sex worker does not mean that you deserve to be attacked. Like, does not mean that you deserve to be attacked and that you're just not going to look into it just because you brought it upon yourself. Like, I don't understand.
Because we are so much more than what we do, right?
Exactly.
We have to be. And so to not even be a human at that point, to truly be apathetic toward their need and to her need in that moment. And not just a sex worker, but someone who's pregnant.
Right.
And has been. What? Like,
Yeah.
Golly.
I know. Seriously. Well, Khalil denied involvement in Tiffany's attack just as much as he denied being involved in the murder of Robin West or Sarah Butler or Joanne Brown. His defense attorneys argued that there was no physical evidence tying him to any of the crimes, but the pathologist testified that he had worn gloves and condoms during all of these attacks and that a small amount of DNA actually belonging to Khalil was found under Sarah's fingernails, but none of the other victims.
So even though he tried to protect himself, there are still traces. So there is still DNA or matter to be able to bring him to justice. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, kind of. So what I would imagine the obvious counter to the fact that, Khalil's DNA was under Sarah's fingernails is like they were having sex. And so just because they were having sex, and DNA was under the fingernails doesn't necessarily mean that he killed her. It just means that like he was definitely there, which like he admitted to, right? Like he said, like, yes, I was hanging out with these girls. I had sex with these girls. I dropped them off afterwards. Everything was fine. But again, it just kind of blows my mind that the defense here is like, and again, they have to do their jobs, sure, whatever, like do your job better, in my opinion. But like you're saying, like there was nothing connecting him to any of these crimes, except for him, by his own admission, saying I was there hours before every single one of these women died or was attacked. It's just odd.
I could never be a defense attorney anyway because of reasons like this. Like once I knew I couldn't, but it infuriates me that you're right. All the DNA under the fingernail points to is that his story is correct.
Right.
At this point, that's what it points to. Sure. He's just basically saying, yes, my alibi is just strengthening it.
Right.
Really.
Right. Well, and we also know based on Tiffany's encounter with Khalil, that we also know that, the idea that he wore gloves and had all this, protection around his, skin and all that stuff to ensure that transfer didn't happen was true. Right. Because that's that matched up to what Tiffany experienced.
You're right. Golly. So please tell me that even though his attorney is laying this out, that they were together, but he did not commit the crimes that they are saying, please tell me that the jury sees something different and that there is some kind of movement.
Yeah, well, good news here, Heather, the part of this, part of the question that you were asking before that you are going to like, was that when all was said and done, the jury was compelled by Tiffany's testimony and saw too much evidence that tied Khalil to all four victims, mainly that cell phone evidence. And on December 23rd, 2019, after a two-month trial, and after deliberating for less than 3 hours, they found Khalil Wheeler Weaver guilty on all charges, and a judge sentenced him to 160 years in prison, saying that the purpose of the length of the sentence was to ensure that he, quote, never walks free in society again.
And this is where we celebrate, because justice was served.
Cheers to that, right? Oh my gosh.
I'm telling you, what... Yeah. A wild story.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, not quite over yet, Heather, for sure. So hold on to that just a little bit there.
Oh, my goodness. I've got to buckle back up.
Yeah, I sure do. You got to buckle yourself back in for sure. But I have to say, going back to a little bit here, like talking about the women who took this monster down. Like it was I think back to Sarah Butler's sister and her friends who bravely, like we were talking about, set up that fake profile. I don't believe that we would have, had the evidence that we had against him if they didn't do that. And then Tiffany, to the bravery that it took to get up there during a trial, because a lot of women don't do that. A lot of women go through what she went through and said, nope, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to press charges. I want to move on with my life. Like, I'm sorry, but no, I can't do it. And she said, nope, I'm going to do it anyways. And you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to lay out every single card on the table and make sure you never see the light of day ever again. And that's exactly what she did.
And that's such a big deal, because you're right, to face their trauma, to look at the face of evil. Mm-hmm. To look Khalil in the eyes and say, this is what he did to me. Knowing that they still, the jury, they could not believe you. They could still, right? That other attorney, his job is to paint a negative picture of you. And yet you wanted to share the truth as well as protect these other women's legacies, to protect their story, to make sure that Khalil was not able to do this again. That is... so much bigger than just bravery, right?
Well, and to going back to what you're talking about with the defense attorney, like, not only is their job to make them, to make you not look good, but like, your job, their job is to prove you, or try to prove you, to be a liar. And so so I can't imagine, like, you know, going through that traumatic thing and then having someone there trying to poke holes in every single piece of that, and being brave and like, knowing that's going to happen and being brave enough to do it anyways. And also too, because kind of like the plus side and the minus side of the way the criminal justice system works, a big minus sign is how long trials can take, or how long, you know, we can it can take to get to a trial. This was 3 years after all these attacks happened Khalil's trial finally played out. And it's not for nothing either, but like we're talking about December 2019. God forbid that trial was delayed by 3 months. We could have been kicking this ball down the court another year, you know, because of what happened in March of 2020. And so point being is that so the fact that you were brave enough 3 years after this attack, you probably, you know, kind of suppressed a lot of the emotions that you've gotten from experiencing this attack, and then had to stir it back up again. You probably have, you know, figured out a way to suppress the nightmares, and I'm sure they came right back. I'm sure they did, right? After knowing that you were going to talk about it, knowing that there was going to be someone there trying to poke the holes in every single piece of the story.
Absolutely. It definitely messes with you, because you know what was real. You were there.
Right.
And not only was it traumatic, and not only the life of your child was put in danger, but... And then you were told that you're a liar.
Right.
Right? That you, because of what you do for a living, that you can't be trusted or validated in what you experience. But then you're right to reopen that wound that had healed probably a tiny bit at that point.
Right.
To reopen it and to go, golly, I'm so grateful, though, that she did, and that she was able to bring, could you imagine, as I can't even imagine how tough it was to hear, right? And to be in the courtroom setting and to know that your daughters are never coming home. You're never going to hear their voice or feel their hug or laugh at their jokes again. And to be in the courtroom and experience that. But the closure that this gave them, that they know that the person who took the lives of their precious babies is not going to be able to do this again to anybody else at that point.
Well, and two, this is probably maybe a little step too far, but like, I like to go a step too far oftentimes in this podcast. And so, but with the parents too, because the circumstances of all four of these attacks were so similar. Right. Like pretty much, you know, copy paste kind of thing. You know, it was a sex in exchange for money. You know, they met on these websites, and then they met up, you know, duct tape around the face, you know, clothing tied around the neck, all that stuff. And so point being is, as a parent, like, as like, you know, as Robin West's father, as, you know, as Sarah Butler's mother, sitting there and hearing more or less almost exactly what happened to your daughter from someone who survived it. Devastating. Yeah. Devastating.
Oh, for sure. And you have to think, like, why? I mean, I could imagine thinking as the parent, like, why did Tiffany survive and not my baby?
Right. Right.
That has to.
But again, you know, I get a little closer in the fact that he's behind bars again. You know, like the judge said, never walk free in society again. That feels good. But unfortunately, Heather, this feels kind of good right now. We're out right now. But the full truth of the horror that Khalil had likely inflicted on women across the state of New Jersey wasn't quite over yet. Because in March 2022, new charges were laid against Khalil. New charges related to a fifth victim that he is accused of murdering just as brutally as the first three. Crime Over Wine is proud to support Emancipet. Unlike episodes of Crime Over Wine, veterinary care shouldn't be a mystery, which is why Emancipet is making vet care affordable and accessible to everyone. Emancipet is a nonprofit organization that operates an ever-expanding network of low-cost veterinary clinics in neighborhoods across the country, offering discounted and free vaccines, flea and tick treatments, spay and neuter surgeries, and much more. Learn more and support Emancipet's mission at emancipet.org. Khalil was charged with murder, attempted sexual assault of a minor, endangering the welfare of a child, and desecration of human remains. It was tied back to a 15-year-old girl from Newark, New Jersey, who was last seen on October 7, 2016, right in the middle of his reign of terror, and the details of her death are eerily similar. The girl's name was Mawa Dumbia. Police say she was last seen alive by her father and sister leaving her home in Newark, but was never reported missing for some reason. Almost 3 years later, on April 19th, 2019, a body was found in a vacant building in Orange, New Jersey. She had been strangled to death using a piece of clothing. In November of 2021, the remains were identified as Mawa's. Police say they gathered evidence that Mawa had chatted with Khalil's profile online and he solicited her to have sex in exchange for money. They met up together at that abandoned home, and he's accused of strangling her to death and leaving her body in the building. Now, Khalil's trial related to what he's accused of doing to Mawa is still playing out as of February of 2024, but police are confident that between the time frame and the similarities that Khalil is their guy in Mawa's case, too. And prosecutors say that they could not rule out that there are other victims of Khalil's who have yet to be identified.
Oh my goodness. Never did I imagine this. Not only to have another one, but to... a serial killer at this point.
A 15-year-old girl. Yeah, and to be clear, too, so, like, a serial killer by FBI's definition is three or more in similar circumstances. And so that definitely ties here.
So he is.
Correct. He's definitely, he meets the FBI definition. But a 15-year-old girl. And it just, it breaks my heart, like... And again, I don't know anything about Mawa's, like, home life or what she was like or what was going on. But, like, the fact that she was never reported missing just absolutely... Mm-hmm. breaks me.
Does like break your heart?
Seriously, it has to, because she had, like, she had a family, she had parents, and, like, nobody was looking for her. Like, that is, like, that's, like, my biggest fear in life, which, like, I know this would never happen because I have way too many people in my life who love me, but, like, it just breaks, not that Mawa didn't, just to be clear, but, like, it's just my biggest fear that, like, something happens to me and no one knows where I am, knows how to find me, or even is looking for me to begin with. Like, oh, that just gives me that's like I can handle all the rest of it, but like to be somewhere cold, quiet, and nobody's out there looking for me is terrifying.
Absolutely. And we know that she had a father and sister, so it does leave you to wonder,
right,
what did their relationship look like, or was Mawa known to you know, go off for a little bit and come back? And what I am not saying is that she deserved what happened.
Right.
But it does make you question kind of what that relationship looked like. Because you're right. I couldn't imagine knowing that you were expecting to see somebody and then you haven't. Right. And it'd be a surprise. So that's... So I know that we don't know, but do you think that they are consistently, as other bodies are potentially found, do you think that they are trying to link more to him? Or is it one of those he's already behind bars so that they don't worry about it?
No, I'm sure they're trying to find more victims, right? Because I mean, at the very least, it's closure for like one more family if there are indeed more victims out there. Because also, it's kind of interesting to me because it's all happening like a month apart, kind of thing, right? Because it's like August 31st was when Robin West went missing and died. Then there was Mawa on October 7th. Then there was on October 22nd there was Joanne who went missing. Then Tiffany was attacked on November 15th. A week later, there was Sarah Butler. So, like, I almost kind of wonder, like, the fact that those were too close apart. Like, again, Sarah, like, Tiffany, you know, escaped. And so, therefore, maybe he was like, I need to kill somebody to, like, scratch this itch. And there was Sarah. And so point being is that like, it all happens. I think from what they've told me, from what I've read, it's about 90 days apart from when Robin went missing and died to when Sarah went missing, who is the most recent victim. And so point being is like it almost makes you wonder if they go back further. Like, are there more women who went missing in like July of 2016 in like the Orange, New Jersey area? You know, like going back even further, or like did something happen to him that made him want to start attacking women in late August? Like, who knows? It could be either way, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and it does. I often wondered. I am not a psychologist, and neither are you. I often wonder. Because I know people that bad things have happened to. They have not had great upbringings. They have experienced really difficult times in their lives and events. But they are not going around hurting people physically. Right. And or in a gruesome fashion like this has been. So what do you think? Is it something in somebody's brain that switches? Do you think that people are born either prone to commit acts of murder or assault, or they're not? Like, what do you think? Or is it something that they experience something that their body just can't, and then they have this need? I've always wondered, what is it that separates?
You know, I'm certainly not a psychologist, right? But I have to imagine that, you know, someone who was born that way, like, just has that instinct, and for whatever reason, like, it just was never like no one ever helped them not experience that, or like they were able to suppress it enough that they didn't act on that until a certain age. So I don't know, but I also have to say too, because so we're talking about five different women, and with the exception of Sarah, all like the other four women, from what I can tell, and we don't really know a whole lot about Mawa again, because the trial against Khalil related to her case is still playing out. But certainly in the case of the other three women, they were vulnerable women. They were women who, you know, like you were saying, were known, were participating in activities that led them to not be very routine, not be very not be very consistent, you know what I mean? Like not be around at certain places at certain times. It was really just whenever life took them to wherever, that's where life happened. And so kind of like Khalil, not to say that like one makes it better or worse than the other, but like Khalil like preyed on these women, right? Because it was women who, and even in the cases, I'll rope Sarah right into this as well, Heather, because even in that case, it was, you know, they all like, you know, like needed this, right? Like they needed that, like they did this to survive, right? Like to you know, because this is what their way of living. And even in Sarah's case too, it was like she, like I have to imagine there was a certain level of like wanting companionship or something like that, you know, maybe like whatever it may be. But like point being is they all trusted Khalil to give them that to a certain extent, right? Because sex is such like an intimate thing, obviously. And they gave it, they allowed him, and it just, anyways, point being is that like it makes it that much nastier to me that like these women were in such a vulnerable place in their lives, and he probably knew in the back of their head that most of these women, there was not going to be anyone really looking for them that intensely.
Right. And that does make me think there had to be a mental health component, because in order to be able to charm someone so someone feels safe, because they were put in dangerous situations, but the three that we know about would have been able, right, you would think, to decipher whether a situation was actually safe or not. So they did trust, but he had to have some kind of charisma or charm for them to trust him. So, but then to be able to switch, I mean, we've talked about this, right? Elle Winston, happy people don't kill people. And so when we know that, something had to shift to then turn him into this monster who brutally murdered them.
Yeah. And again, I'll remind people, you know, Khalil's been convicted in the murder of Robin, and the murder of Joanne, and in the murder of Sarah, and in the attack of Tiffany. But the case against him related to Mawa's case is still playing out right now. But again, I mean, the similarities are striking, right? And so I just have to say that much. But I guess because I usually don't do cases that are kind of playing out and could change and, you know, could go one way or the other because I don't, you know, want to mess with that. Right. But it just felt important to say that, like, you know, that, you know, to you know, I couldn't do a whole case about four victims when there was a fifth one out there. You know what I mean?
Because she's just as important.
Yeah, exactly. Heather. That is all that we have for you this week. That's all. Thank you so much for coming
loaded.
On. It sure is. It was a loaded case, but thank you so much for coming on and taking it. I told you I had a big one for you. And did I disappoint?
No, you did not. I'm so grateful that this case, unlike so many of yours, right, actually came to justice.
Yeah.
And is hopefully going to come to justice. And so, because they don't always have an ending, mm-hmm. that we do have the closure and we do have that sense of peace. And for the parents and the friends and family of the victim, for them to also feel that. And so I'm so grateful that as terrible as all of this is, that we are able to see a little bit about who these women were.
Yeah.
And be able to celebrate the fact that the person who took their lives is put away.
Yeah. Well, tell everyone, Heather, turn in from a, you know, tragic, horrible situation to the joy that you bring on your podcast. Tell everyone where they can find you and your work online.
So y'all are able to find Heather's Most Precious on your favorite podcast streaming platform. So wherever you like to listen to them, definitely check out Heather's Most Precious. And I would encourage you, if you have a really cool story to share, if you feel like you're doing really something cool in this world, or you want to be able to share what you find most precious, definitely reach out to us. You can find us on Instagram and on Facebook under Heather's Most Precious. And you can also email us at heathersmostprecious@gmail.com.
Awesome. And when do you put out episodes?
Every Thursday at 5:30 a.m. So we try to catch those early risers too, if you want to listen on the way to work.
Yeah, I love that. Well, thank you again so much for coming on, Heather. And thank you all so much for listening. We are going to put all of our sources on our website so you can read everything for yourself and probably come up with a few theories too. And if you are just loving this podcast and are just looking for a way to tell everyone and anyone about it, the best way to help people discover this podcast is by leaving us a 5-star rating and a review wherever you are listening right now. So make sure you follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And if you're wondering what we have in store for you next week, here's a quick sneak peek. Hello, everybody. It's Liam. And a few weeks ago, I did a live show, Crime Over Wine Live, at Amada Tapas and Wine in beautiful downtown Chattanooga, where I shared the story of Jamie Faith, a husband from Texas who was gunned down unexpectedly while out for a morning walk with his wife and his dog. Next week, I am going to share the recording of that live show with you, including the surprise twist that just goes to show you that you truly don't know anyone. I'll share that story with you next Wine Wednesday on another episode of Crime Over Wine.
Proud member of the Podnougan Network.